Does altruism exist? And I should actually start at page one of my notes. That's probably a good place to start. Here we go. So, the problem of altruism. First, does it actually exist? I need to define our terms, and I'm going to define them in a fairly conventional way. As you see it there, acting to benefit another without expectation of benefit in return. And we'll tease out some of the nuances here as we proceed. Why is this question important? I'm going to identify three reasons it's important. First, altruistic actions depend on free will to act for the benefit of another. That is, one freely chooses to act altruistically. Thus, the existence of altruism depends on the prior existence of free will. However, mainstream neuroscience today denies the existence of free will, and mainstream evolutionary biology denies the existence of altruism, at least by the conventional definition I just gave a moment ago. So, we will come to the reasons for these denials shortly, but these two denials are significant strikes against Christianity and against Christian understanding of both God and humanity. So, a Christian worldview that is persuasive both to scientifically minded Christians and to scientifically minded seekers is going to have to provide a viable account of both free will and altruism. Today I'll not be addressing the free will part, but I will be addressing the altruism part. A second reason why this question is important. The capacity for altruism is a crucial aspect of how Christians understand agape love. For instance, the ability to love one's neighbor is in part dependent on the capacity for altruism, the capacity to act to benefit another without expectation of benefit in return, as in, for instance, the parable of the Good Samaritan. Likewise, with the ability to love one's enemy, which is a form of loving one's neighbor. So the denial of altruism is, by implication, a denial of the possibility of agape love. Clearly, Christians need to be able to respond to this. Thirdly, I'm currently writing a book in which I take on the question of teleology or purpose in the universe. Materialists or atheists, of course, hold that the universe has no purpose. I argue, however, that agape love is the purpose of the universe. So I come up with Berger's teleology hypothesis, which reads as follows. God created the universe to provide the space and conditions for the eventual and inevitable emergence of habitable bioniches in which love-capable beings would emerge to live in agape love relations with God and with others. Earth is one such emergent bioniche, and Homo sapiens are an instance of such emergent agape-loving beings. I believe this proposal solves a number of problems in current Christian apologetics within the context of contemporary science. However, if this proposal is to succeed, one of the many problems it has to address is the issues of free will and altruism. And I address free will elsewhere, but today we're going to talk about altruism. Talk about free will elsewhere, but altruism today. Let's talk about the origins of the very word itself. The concept of altruism is a jumble of ideas in the literature today that needs to be untangled if we're to make any sense of what it's about. So if we start at the beginning, the word altruism is the anglicized version of the word altruisme, which was first coined by Auguste Comte in the mid-1800s. Comte, of course, was one of the founding figures of sociology. For Comte, altruisme meant to live for others. Indeed, as Comte himself said, altruism, to live for others, is the core element of his whole moral code. Yet Comte held an unusually extreme view of living for others, what this means, in that he denied any place for the individual's own desires or needs. He held this extreme view because he was such a rigid communitarian, holding that society as a whole is all that counts. And the needs and desires of individuals need to be subsumed within the needs of society, except perhaps in the case of families. Many of you will remember Margaret Thatcher thought that society does not exist, only individuals exist. Comte was virtually the exact opposite position. For Comte, one's commitment to society should be so complete that no action should ever be motivated by hope of reciprocity or mutuality. In short, altruisme was the word he coined to convey the idea of total concern for others without regard to benefit for oneself. Now, let me talk about the selfish interpretation of altruism. Regardless of Comte's own intentions, altruism has come to be used in ways that are very different from what he intended. In fact, sometimes completely opposite to what he intended. Skeptical philosophers argued, even in Comte's own day, that we cannot live Comte's form of altruism because humans are basically and fundamentally selfish. And the technical term in philosophy is egoism. In other words, those who claim that their motivation for a particular compassionate action is solely to benefit the other person are actually motivated, whether consciously or subconsciously, by wanting to benefit themselves. So, there are three possible reasons one would act with the appearance of, say, compassion, but actually be acting to benefit oneself. One is to relieve one's own feelings of distress when faced with the suffering of others, or to avoid some kind of punishment, say for failing to live up to the expectations of society or some group or of God, or to gain some sort of external reward, such as merit or status in the eyes of others or of God. I will call this the egoistic interpretation of altruism, self-centered altruism. Of course, Comte would say that self-centered altruism is an oxymoron, like saying married bachelor. In recent times, this denial of genuine altruism has been reinforced from another direction, namely by evolutionary biology. For evolutionary biologists, apparently selfless acts are really intended simply to maximize reproductive fitness. It's not news. When discussing altruism, evolutionary biologists begin with an observation from the animal world, namely that among animals there is a common phenomena of self-sacrifice on behalf of one's relatives or one's kin. This self-sacrifice for kin can be by various means. For instance, by suicide, such as spiders, in which one mate submits themselves to be eaten by usually the female, or by risk, warning in-group members of a nearby predator and therefore drawing the attention of the predator upon themselves. Or by sterility. Many insect species have colony members who are sterile in their role of serving their fertile queen. In each such case, the animal's ability to reproduce, to ensure their own reproductive fitness, seems to be sacrificed for the reproductive success and genetic fitness of their kin. This is called kin selection. For those of you familiar with this terrain, this is where Hamilton's rule comes in. We don't have time today to explain Hamilton's rule. However, the point to which I want to draw our attention at this moment is that in kin selection, what appears on the surface to be very generous self-sacrifice for the reproductive benefit of one's relatives actually turns out to be nothing more than a self-centered way of carrying on one's own genes. As J.B.S. Haldane famously quipped, he would be willing to sacrifice himself for two siblings, four nephews, or eight cousins. as these would equally carry on his genes. Consequently, many evolutionary biologists presuppose that self-sacrifice for non-kin cannot even exist. Yet this denial that genuine altruism exists either towards one's kin or beyond one's kin or beyond one's in-group even conflicts with social science data, which in my reading of the literature, evolutionary biologists rarely engage with. So responding to this selfish interpretation, social science research by figures such as Jean Deschetis, Daniel Batson, and the Oleners argues that other-centered altruism does indeed exist. With more time, I would describe the interesting work by Daniel Batson's lab. However, because of time limitations, I'm just going to describe briefly the research of the sociologists Pearl and Samuel Oliner. And this research is a bit older now, it's the mid-1980s, but I think they're, it simplifies the ability to understand elements of what's happening in genuine other-centered altruism. In the 1980s, the Oleners interviewed 406 individual Gentiles who had rescued Jews during the Second World War. And they also interviewed 126 people who had chosen not to rescue Jews and 150 Jewish rescuees. Most of the rescuers interviewed engaged in their rescuing activities for more than 2 years, so it's a sustained period of time. Most helped individuals of different cultures and ethnicities. In other words, not only non-kin, but also non-in-group. And all lived their lives under extremely stressful and dangerous conditions to protect those they were hiding, with no conceivable benefit to themselves beyond the sense of simply doing what is right. Indeed, as is well known, many rescuers were discovered and killed by the Nazis for their efforts. Here is one rescuer story of a Polish Gentile woman who took into her care a Jewish child at the request of its mother. This Gentile tells of her experience protecting the infant. I'll ask Judy McLaughlin to please read to us this, this paragraph by this woman.
One time, I was
emaciated. Clearly, the personal cost of this Gentile woman's efforts to save the Jewish infant was high. This rescuer knew full well at the beginning of this venture and throughout as well that someday giving back the child would be necessary if indeed the child's mother survived the war. One can imagine the level of attachment this rescuer developed with the child. After investing so much care and self-sacrifice and risk into protecting this child for so long, one can then only imagine the pain of giving this child back to its mother. This is an individual example of altruistic behavior with no fitness benefit, nor external benefit in return, just years of stress and suffering. And there are also other examples of what could be called collective altruistic culture, however, because of time, I'm going to have to move on. Does a genuine altruist receive any benefit at all? A genuine altruist does not expect reproductive fitness or external benefit in return, either from the one they help or from some other external source of reward, but that does not mean they receive no benefit at all. There can be a self-benefit of feeling what I call subjective moral reward, such as having done the right thing, taken the moral high ground, fulfilled my responsibility or made the world a better place. Feelings which might or might not have been consciously in the mind of the actor at the time of their self-sacrificial action. This sort of weak, subjective, internal reward does not bring the sorts of strong rewards or self-benefits that egoists and evolutionary biologists argue must really motivate supposedly altruistic acts. The altruistic action may even come at great personal cost, even be anonymous. Anonymous acts to benefit others, including to benefit non-kin and non-in-group members, happen all the time in life. And yet, it seems to me that most evolutionary biologists, at least in the kin selection mode, have painted themselves into a corner, having to deny such a possibility and having no explanation. I contend that this weak subjective reward altruism is absolutely essential to the well-being of humanity and our planet. The motive to sacrifice one's own interests for the well-being of another, including strangers, perhaps without recognition by others, simply because it is the right thing to do in a particular circumstance, is crucially important, is a crucially important component of humanity's ability to flourish, and by extension, of our planet to flourish as well. In terms of how this human capacity for subjective reward altruism has come about, I see this as a problematic question for evolutionary biology in its current kin selection mode. And even more challenging for evolutionary biology is the phenomenon of self-sacrifice, so no reward whatsoever, not even for weak subjective reward. For instance, one person jumping in the way of an oncoming vehicle to save the life of a stranger and losing their own life along the way. So I'm going to have to cut down a bit. Let me just highlight a couple of linguistic consequences, conceptual consequences of this. Two misuses of the word altruism. The phrase, some of you may be familiar with the phrase reciprocal altruism, in which an organism temporarily diminishes its own reproductive fitness in order to increase the reproductive fitness of another organism in anticipation that at some future time the favor might be returned, if circumstances permit. I don't know how that happens at a cellular level. One cell says to another cell, pay me back sometime. This is not contra to those who are familiar with Martin Novak and Sarah Polkley and their recent work with others. I do not see this as cooperation. I see cooperation and altruism as two different phenomena, including at the neurological level. Cooperation expects or anticipates some eventual equivalent benefit in return. Altruism, on the other hand, expects no equivalent eventual favor or benefit in return. In effect, reciprocal altruism is an oxymoron, because unlike cooperators, the true altruist does not expect to be reciprocated at anything close to an equivalent level, if at all. And some of you may know this phrase, altruistic punishment, and I won't get into it more, but it's an oxymoron again, because altruism benefits. It doesn't punish. But because of this misinterpretation, I would argue, of what altruism is through the kin selection mode, we end up with these two oxymoronic uses of the term altruism. And so in the case of altruistic punishment, just drop the word, drop the modifier. There's not even a need for the modifier altruistic, because altruism benefits, not punishes. Should we have two types of altruism? Some people, I'm not the first to recognize the incongruity between how the word altruism is used. So some people have said, let's just have two uses of the word altruism, one being biological altruism, one being psychological altruism. I would say no, because basically this allows evolutionary biologists in this kin selection mode, in its current kin selection mode, to keep their misleading understanding or misuse of the word altruism. So I would argue that just leave altruism for the level of social psychology. Okay. An important, what about implications? One implication of what I've been saying is that we as Christians can defend the existence of agape love. We don't need to fear that the existence of agape love is going to be pulled out from under our feet by evolutionary biology. Another implication is that altruism can be nurtured. As one example, I would point to the Roots of Empathy program out of Toronto, in which and their mission is to build caring, peaceful, and civil societies through the development of empathy in children and adults. Founded in 1996, to date the program has reached over 500,000 children worldwide. In this program, a parent and a baby, and the baby is 2 to 4 months old, visit a classroom 9 times over the course of a school year. A trained Roots of Empathy instructor visits the class with the family to guide pupils in the classroom as they observe the relationship between the baby and her parent. With each family visit, the instructor leads the students in noticing how the baby is growing and changing over the course of his or her first year of life. The children also watch the loving relationship between the parent and baby, see the patterns of attachment, to see how the parent responds to the baby's emotions, meets the baby's needs. Children learn to, the pupils in the class, over the course of the year, learn to understand the perspective of the baby and label the baby's feelings, and then are guided to extending this learning outwards so they have a better understanding of their own feelings and a better understanding of the feelings of others. A decade of independent academic research across several countries has consistently shown that this program dramatically reduces aggression and increases social and emotional understanding among children who participate. These children are kinder, more cooperative, and more inclusive of others. And these effects are shown to last for years. Altruism can also be nurtured in ourselves. For example, Jean Vanier, Dorothy Day, Pandita Rai Mabai, and many others. The net result. First, as I said, Christians need not lose confidence in the real existence of agape love. And second, Christians can argue in the public square that the capacity for genuine other-centered altruism is a part of human nature, that the nurturance of altruistic character to non-kin, these arguments can be made within public contexts such as education systems, justice systems, public policy, and that this is essential for the well-being of society and our planet. Thank you. This happens to be my favorite part, verse from scripture that kind of instantiates what I've been talking about. So, questions? Fits with, there's an American philosopher a couple years ago made a similar argument. Any philosophers in the crowd? No. So I'm not going to mention his name because I can't remember right now. But her argument, I've noticed, fits well with this other fellow. I'll get his name for you. And I haven't seen in the literature anyone putting these two together, but I think there's a mutual support there that these two provide. I'll get that name for you. Rejecting the philosophical.
Well, saying that altruism is nothing but false things, saying, no, of course not. I mean, that's the mechanism of altruism. And while still rejecting the philosophical claim that altruism is nothing but false things.
I'm taking it that behind your question, you've got an answer to that. I'd be interested in hearing that.
Well, I do think it's self definition of separateness. You can't get into the sort of the mechanism debate. Mm-hmm. While explicitly calling attention, as you have done, mm-hmm. to the sort of philosophical Adam and nothing but Adam, but not rejecting all of the claims that maybe groups like it wasn't.
I think part of what you're pointing out actually applies methodologically, not just here, but in all kinds of Christian and faith questions. So, I mean, rather than answer your question, I would respond by simply pointing that out, that what you're saying, I would agree with, and it can be applied across a range of issues. That's important. Is altruism the act, or is altruism the intention? And if you're putting it at the intention level, how do you know it's actually the intention? Because we even misidentify our own intentions. On the intention question, I'd refer you to some of the work by Daniel Batson. I mean, he's not a Christian, but his lab has done really interesting stuff at identifying levels of motivation and intentionality with regards to altruistic actions. From a theological perspective, we are sinners, and part of that is we don't recognize our own motivations so very much. I tend to focus on altruism as the motivation. What are you actually consciously or subconsciously wanting to do? Your intention may be to benefit the person with no desire for benefit in return, no desire for recognition. Your actual action may not actually benefit the other person. You may misinterpret their situation and cause them harm. Is that an altruistic act then? I would argue technically, yes it is, because the balance lays on the motivation. Whether they made a good judgment in that altruistic act is another matter. Does that make sense? So I missed the part after the Sermon on the Mount?
Great Lord, you're working in heaven.
Oh, yes. Right. That's a good question. Because what I've been talking about is altruism without any sense of reward, external reward. I've been talking about this subjective reward of just doing this because this makes the world better or whatever. When God promises a reward and we do it because, you know, I'll get my reward in heaven, I think that is a form of altruism, because what I haven't talked about is levels of benefit in return. And so elsewhere I do argue that altruism can't, as long as the cost it exceeds the desired reward, then it's still altruistic. For instance, you give money to a charity. Do you want a charitable tax receipt in return to decrease your taxes? Even if you do want that charitable tax receipt, the cost to you is still greater than the benefit, and it is therefore still altruistic. And so if we are wanting reward from God, it is still altruistic. But I would see the implication of that, at least in terms of evolutionary biology, is it's still not what evolutionary biologists would consider a strong reward.
Okay.
Because it's deferred in time and space and in relationship with God. So that because of that significant deferral of benefit into eternal life, it would still not be a strong reward in terms of evolutionary biology. But it is still, it can, Christian, on a Christian understanding of altruism, it can still be considered an altruistic act, even though someday we expect a 10 times reward in eternal life.
Okay, we're out of time.